While you're listening, go to arcpodnet.com/members and support our efforts. Let's get to the show.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 189.
On today's show, we interview author and director Thomas Sirotu about the book and documentary Lady Sapiens.
Let's dig a little deeper, but, you know, let's pay attention this time and not just make assumptions about what we're digging up.
No biases.
No biases. Welcome to the show, everyone. Rachel, how's it going?
Very good. This week we are coming again. I think the last episode we did too, but we're coming from Reno, our home base, I guess you could say.
Yeah, former home base.
So, yeah.
Yep. And we're in the grips of the heat wave that pretty much everyone is. And I think every day this week it's been over 100. Yesterday was like 106. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
the hottest day on record in Reno, like in September and also in August and also in like July, I think. So just ridiculous. Yeah.
And if you like following our RV travels too, we have some surprises coming on that end. Maybe follow our Instagram channel, Roadster Adventures, and you can see some of that. There should already be some stuff up by the time you're listening to this for sure. So we'll say more about that later. But for now, we've got an exciting interview. So look into the show notes. For longtime listeners, we have episode 171 was a news episode, and we mentioned at least one thing that where one of our references was the book Lady Sapiens and the documentary of the same name. And we now have, just through random chance, because his publisher, I think, reached out or somebody, an agency or somebody, we don't have one of the authors of that book, Thomas. I'm going to get this wrong. He's French. Thomas Sirotu. Sirotu. How did I do?
It's perfect.
Nice. Well,
Hi, Chris. Hi, Rachel. I'm very glad to join you here to talk about this project, Lady Sapiens. Here in Paris, it's very rainy weather, and it's not as hot in Reno.
Nice.
You're lucky, I think. I wish I would take some rainy weather right now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to push the rain through the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, exactly. Before Thomas really gets going, let's introduce him with his short bio real quick. So Thomas Sirotu is an author and director. He created and co-wrote the documentary Lady Sapiens that we're going to talk about today. He also directed the documentary Who Killed the Neanderthal, which he co-wrote with Eric Pincus and Jacques Melitere. This film received a number of prizes in France and abroad, and I'm sure it's fantastic. Okay, so let's talk about Lady Sapiens. Now, first off, from an archaeological perspective, as everybody knows, Rachel and I are both archaeologists. We've worked in the cultural resource management industry for over a decade in this country, well over a decade in the United States. And, you know, there's always, from schooling on through to even texts that people are using today, there's always this sort of underlying assumption that certain things are done by men and certain things are done by women. And that is really just a holdover from really, I think, modern biases, to be honest with you, where, you know, men tend to be bigger and therefore do, you know, more physically demanding jobs. Women tend to be smaller and maybe do less physically demanding jobs. And that just, when you get to a hunter-gatherer society, that turns into, well, men are hunting and women are gathering. It's just like, you know, boils across those lines, and it's done. And archaeology has towed that sort of narrative for, I mean, 150 years of archaeological narrative and research. And I'm glad to report that, you know, we're finding out that that's not actually true. It might be in some places where that it's a little bit true, but it's a lot more fluid than that. So, Thomas, why don't you tell us a little bit about what led you to the work that eventually led to Lady Sapiens?
Well, Chris and Rachel, that's exactly what we thought when we started to work on that project, Lady Sapiens, because we have all this image from the 19th century archaeologist, prehistorian, that was very deep inside our mind that, well, you know, you have this world divided in two, women were hunting and women was gathering, and all was written. And but as we started to work on this project, at that time it was about 3 to 4 years from now. There was a major discovery in evolution. For we found a skull in Morocco, Homo sapiens, and it tells a quite a new story about our species, about the evolution of the species. But each time we heard about that story, we were only hearing about the story of mankind, and we were thinking about where's the woman here?
Yeah.
Why are we always talking about mankind? Or yeah. You know, so we wanted to put the lights on the other part of the humanity that represent 50% of humanity, the woman, and we started to make an investigation on that subject. And we meet our scientific advisor, Sophie de Beaune, who just had written an article on that subject about all those research during this 30 years of archaeological, biological, genetics research about what was the role of women, what was their status, what was the place inside those tribes of the Upper Paleolithic. Because the period we were talking about in Lady Sapiens is the Upper Paleolithic. So that's quite from minus 45,000 years ago from minus 10,000 years ago.
Okay.
And we discover a lot of things. And what strikes us is that the role of each gender, which now we think as gender, which won't be the same, we surely won't be the same in those very ancient times, the role of women and men were very, as you said, fluid. So it's mainly about competence. Well, I mean, maybe much more about knowledge, about capabilities of every people, every man and woman, more than a gender role inside those tribes.
Okay, that makes sense.
So we talked about your book back in, it was earlier this year, when we first heard about it, we read an article in The Guardian, and it really set off this like train of thought for me that it was a path I had never gone down before, but how our modern biases, and by modern, I mean archaeologists in 1900s who began the whole archaeological field and the biases that they had at that time period, how they influenced the field of archaeology so much. And that was such a like lightning bolt moment for me. And I'm thinking it probably would be for a lot of people who haven't really thought about how that would have influenced the way we are interpreting archaeology even until today. So I'm wondering what got you guys to that point where you were trying to break down that bias that happened almost without us even realizing it.
Well, if you remember the context of these 19th century prehistorian you're talking about, is that they have this, as we have today, we have our minds built on what we're living today. So their mind was in their 19th century societies. So that's a society where men have the political, economical, and social power. And so they just put their way of life into those things that they see in those archaeological sites they discovered. And also because they discover mainly on those archaeological sites like Cro-Magnon site, like which was one of the first discovery in France, they discover bones from animals that seem to have been killed by weapons, rocks that has been chopped out to make weapons also for killing those animals, and bones from humans. And they thought that, well, men were hunting, and this is why we evolved, because the men, they found a few other fossils, and they were thinking that during the time, those men were evolving because they invented things, they were creative, the men were creative, I don't know what was doing the woman, in their mind, nothing, and they built weapon more and more efficient for killing those animals, and that's how we evolved through animality to humanity. And this is where how they think.
Yeah.
But now, with all those new discovery, with new analysis in a lot of different fields, we have a very different pattern, as I was saying, about what was the place of the woman. The idea of our project is to really give the woman their rightful place in this great book of prehistory. We would like to lift up the veil of invisibility that, you know, was on those women of prehistory. And so the idea is to look about on all of the things, all the fields. There's this very famous story about the Lady of Cavillon, which was discovered in, just let me look about my my notes. Not to say something wrong. Cavillon was discovered in 1872 by Émile Rivière, which is a French archaeologist. And this is a grave which is dated from minus 24,000 years ago. So wow. A very old grave.
Mm-hmm.
And at the first time, because the bones and the skeleton was, it looks very strong. You know, how you said about the bones are strong because they have, when the person was alive, a very strong muscles. So the muscles are pulling on the bone, and the bones so are strong. And so how are the bones? You can tell about how the muscle are, and how strong is the person. And they thought, okay, those bones are very strong, so the person must be a strong person. And this person must be a man.
Right.
And all that was said. And in this grave, it's a very rich grave from this period, because it has a very nice, a thing on the head with a lots of beads and tooth of deers, which is a very rare and exotic thing for prehistory, for that region, which is near between just France and Italy on the Mediterranean border, and also a lot of necklace, not necklace, but things that you put on side your on your legs, and very nice stones that are chopped out, and a lot of objects, and also there's just on the top of the grave, there's an engraving, a horse that looks like it has been hunted. So they say, okay, it's a man, and it's a very famous man. It has the people who buried that man think that man has a lot of prestige. And those people who put the man inside the earth give them a lot of object that are very rich for his way out in the in this journey towards death. Well, a group of scientists in the very late 90s, so that's the studies started in 1995, which is Marie-Antoinette de Lumley and Henri de Lumley. Well, they wanted to reanalyze the fossil because they had new techniques to measure the bones and the hips, and the hips was telling a very different story, because they found that the opening of the hips correspond to a woman, and so everything was changing now, because it was the same grave with the same object with the same prestige. Those people gave this fossil to with all those objects, precious objects. And it wasn't a man anymore. It was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so was that woman a leader, a huntress? So it very changes the way we archaeologists and prehistorians look on women of prehistory from that time period.
And that, I think, is one of the most important things from research like this, right, is to get existing archaeologists and you know, new archaeologists that are learning in university settings right now to really break down those walls, right? Break down those barriers and to not necessarily look at something and just make assumptions about it, you know, based on, I guess, what they think they know about the world today or what they think they know about prehistory, but to really look at it and say, hey, we've got some new techniques and some new things that we can look at and really figure this out. I'm really thinking about like handedness in lithic technology and stuff like that, where we started to figure out, hey, we can tell if this was made by a left-handed person or a right-handed person sometimes, right? And that's really cool. And it can be a lot more difficult to suss out what gender created something because the techniques may be the same, but they're also like, we watched the documentary and I was really interested in the gentleman who was studying some of these smaller, they weren't like beads, like accessory type items. And he was saying how, you know, he couldn't even make these things at all, but some of his female students and colleagues with smaller hands could actually do that. Mm-hmm. Like with much more ease. Yeah,
Randall White is the name of the researcher who just passed away this year.
Okay.
So it's a very sad thing. That's, mm-hmm. But yes, it was. He told us a lot of things about how he discovered that necklace and all those beads and how he interpret those beads. The person who did it, because those beads were so tiny sometimes that. If a man's hand cannot make it because it's too tiny.
Just too
well,
small.
It's, yeah. It's this is well, for sure you can maybe be not so sure about that assumption or hypothesis because well you said some men have small hands and so it's not, but you know it's a way of thinking thing. With experimental archaeology and mm-hmm. experimental archaeology tell you also some kind of in a lot of situation you have more chance to have this conclusion than the others because it's more likely to be that than to be the other way. So for sure there's exception for man's and man can do very tiny things. But he thinks, and this is his point of view, that women had done those beads more than men. It's more likely.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I got some follow-up questions on that. But first, let's take a break. And when we come back, we will continue talking to Thomas about Lady Sapiens and women's role in prehistory. Back in a minute. Hey everyone, Chris Webster from the APN here. We have used a number of solutions for recording our podcast with interesting people from around the world. None have worked better than Zencastr. For the last several years, we've been using Zencastr for high-quality recordings that are easy to do and put little to no stress on the guest. And now, Zencastr has high-quality video and even automatic transcription. So click the link in the show notes or head over to zencastr.com/pricing and use the code TAS to get 30% off your first 3 months of the Pro Plan. If you're starting a podcast anytime soon, it's totally worth it. Again, click the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months. And they even give a little back to us when you do.
Keep this conversation going by joining our members-only Slack team. There's always vibrant conversations going on over there between members and hosts about the topics we're podcasting about and more. Also get access to our back catalog of bonus material and ad-free shows. You get all this for $7.99 a month or less than $80 US per year if you get the annual subscription. Support archaeological education and outreach by supporting the APN. Go to archpodnet.com/members for details. That's archpodnet.com/members.
Are you listening to this podcast and thinking you'd like to start your own podcast and don't know where to start? Well, Chris Webster, that's me. I'm founder of the APN, and I started podcasting back in 2011. You can learn from my years of experience, and you can do it at your own pace. Head over to propodcastnow.com and click the Learn to Podcast image. My 6 to 8 hour self-guided course will take you from show inception to your first episode, and you'll learn the tools you need to keep it all going and prevent pod fading. That's a real term. You can have access to the materials for as long as you want, and if you stay in for 3 months at least, you'll have lifetime access to the graduates Slack team so you can talk to other people that have taken the course and are managing their own podcasts. Again, head over to propodcastnow.com and click Learn to Podcast. Welcome back to episode 189 of the Archaeology Show. And we've got, I'm going to try his name again. We've got Thomas Scioto from France on to talk about Lady Sapiens, the book that he co-wrote, and documentary of the same name. We're going to link to the book for sure. And I might link to a couple sources of the documentary that we found online here in the show notes. So if you want to see that, take a look down at your show notes and you can do that. So at the end of the last discussion, Thomas, we were talking about that example that's mentioned in the book and in the documentary about the, you know, potentially smaller hands, let's just say, having an easier time creating something. How can we differentiate smaller hands between small-handed men, small-handed women, and children? You know what I mean? Like they might all have... You get like a 12-year-old that might be fully capable of doing this kind of thing, and they could be, gender male and have small hands because they're 12, right? And they're not 25 or something like that yet. So how do we is it even possible to start distinguishing between those kinds of things yet?
Well, what Randall White told us about that is that it has to be it's a very technical issue to build those beads because you have so much different step to go to build these beads. You have to chop big chunk of ivories before and smaller ones, and you have several step also to have those tiny basket beads form of those beads. So it's quite very technical. So it looks for him that's very unlikely that children from 12 years old will be patient enough or skillful enough to make those beads. I won't say that it's not possible, but it's more unlikely than that children make those beads. You have to have a certain knowledge about how making them, and because it's also a way. Surely, when you're wearing this kind of necklace, which is not sure it's a necklace, it could be also on the clothes that you're wearing those beads. It's a way of showing that you are from a certain group with a certain culture, because you're not wearing clothes even now without any symbolical meanings. So at that time also, it meant surely a lot of things. We don't know what, but it means a lot. So it has to be some kind of a way of making those beads in a way that it has to be the group way. And so this is also part of knowledge. So this is why it's more likely be a woman activity than a child activity. Well, surely we cannot tell that it has been from a man with small hands and a woman with small hands. We cannot know. But in most cases, men have stronger hands than women. And you can see maybe in the archaeological record, when you measure your hands, you can see that there's a difference between hands between man and woman, and that we talk about that for art. When we there's a few researchers that works on the form of the hands, because we have these negative and positive hand painting that you can see on the walls of Chauvet, or the Grotte Chauvet in France, or Lascaux Cave also. And in several caves also in Spain or even in Asia, there's a difference between the tallest of the fingers. The fingers, the index, and the ring finger. Normally, men, well, it has to be, it's not a 90% assumption true, but you have this difference between the tallest of those fingers between man and woman. Okay. Women have normally the fingers on the same length, and men don't. So this is how they measure those hands, and they can tell in 75% true that there are more hands women hands on those paintings than men hands on those paintings. Mm. And that, that tells us also another things about those caves, because from a lot of stories from archaeologists I've heard before, women weren't allowed to go in those deep caves because they say it's dangerous. And that's sure, it's dangerous to go inside those deep caves because you don't have lights. Maybe you have animals that are very fearful, like bears or even hyena. Mm-hmm. So it's quite dangerous. And they say what makes me laugh a lot because they say that women cannot use a torch. I say, what? Why? Because they don't know how to build them. Okay.
So oh, man.
Learn how to build a torch. So,
yeah.
Point of view.
And also, they say that because women were so precious, because women carry the destiny of the group. They are, growing children inside their belly. So maybe they weren't allowed to go in those deep caves. And so we asked that to several researchers, and we came to that researcher, Andreas Pastors, from Germany, who is studying the steps, the footsteps inside those caves. And he made a two-way study, the occidental way, measuring the steps and trying to find if there's women and men, and if we can say something with lots of artificial intelligence, trying to grasp the difference between a woman's step and a man's step. And he didn't succeed in this in this way. The way he succeeded is to ask African the San people, who are trekkers, who know how to follow a track for their parents, for their sisters, for their uncles, but also for hunting animals inside Africa, and they are very good at it because they learn when they're very young to know where their mother is going, or their father or their friends, to meet them inside the land. So they are very accurate to tell the story about footprints, because footprints is not a print. It's a story of a movement. And that's very interesting, because the story of the movement tells what was doing that person at that precious moment, when he left this footprints. And he tells us two stories about a woman walking inside those caves. A woman who slept because that's what the San people says. She slept on the floor because it was wet, and she tried not to fall, so she put her foot behind the other to avoid slipping. And the other story is about another woman carrying a baby, and they know that because the tracks of the footstep, one footstep is quite not on the right lane, on the lane of the usual footstep. Like when you're, you have a backpack on your back, and you just wanted to lift it a little bit because it's too heavy and you want to change position. And so you sometimes put a step beside to, when you're doing this movement. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly what they saw inside this movement. And what tells our occidental and scientific mind that's a very precious and also accurate analysis is that they came to the same conclusion as the European researcher. Because the European researcher says that those people, they wanted to discover this very big cave, so they follow these corridors. And at one times when they went about 500 meters inside the cave, they had a problem with the lights. They burned all their torch, So they have to come back very quickly. And this is also what they saw, the San people inside those footsteps. They saw that they came to a certain point and then step back and go back very quickly to find their way back to the lights and to the exterior. And they tell exactly the same story. They find exactly the same number of person as the European scientific way. So it's another way of telling what those first footprints tell us, but it's as scientific. It's more pragmatical, but is as scientific as the European way.
Wow.
That tells us a lot about how we think, but it tells us about women. They were inside those caves. They were deep inside those caves. And so you have those footsteps. And we went to another cave in France, which is called Pêche-Merle, and where you have those wonderful and beautiful horses made of dots, and there's on a big wall, and it's very emotional when you're in front of them, because also you can see the real thing. It's not like in Chauvet or in Lascaux where you see the reproduction of the cave, and it's very nice, those reproductions. Here you are in front of a -25,000 years painting. With small lights, and you see all those details, all those hands hanging out, and you know that those hands, 75% are women. As they are defined as women from several researchers that analyzed them. And and so when you know, we asked those priests, what does this mean? Why putting those hands on the wall just beside those wonderful paintings? And they say, well, there's a lot of argument and there's a lot of hypotheses, but I like one of them. And one of them says is maybe it's a signature. Maybe the artist wanted to put his hand on the wall to say, I've made it. I just put my hand and I say, I made it. Yeah. And see, and so if those hands are women and they were inside the cave, because you have also in Pêche-Merle footprints, women footprints just beside those paintings. Well, I won't say that the horses of Pêche-Merle are made by women, because I can tell that, but I will say really possible, as it's possible also for a man, but it's really possible that women made those fabulous paintings. And that's changing completely your point of view of the role, the place, and the status of women. Because you cannot, I don't know if you draw a lot, you're Rachel or Chris. I'm a terrible.
Not really.
No, I'm pretty bad.
Very, very bad. But when I have kids and my two daughters are pretty good at it, but I see their, from very their first drawing, they build their techniques from long and long years of learning, and now they're good, but they started very young, and so there's a long learning apprentice, for making those drawings. So I'm sure that the artist that painted those wonderful horses has a lot of years of practicing. Right. But in practicing is that you won't be able maybe to hunt or to build your clothes or to, do the everyday life things of the groups must do. So the other ones has to make them for you. So you have a special role as an artist, as a person who is capable. Maybe they don't choose the word artist. That's maybe for sure. They're not considered as an artist. I don't know what do they think about those person capable of drawing those painting on the walls. Maybe there are some kind of, intercessor between the world of the spirit and the real world, or they are have special power. I don't know how those people from those paleolithic times think about the capability of certain person to draw animals on the walls. But for sure, those people, those artists, has to be a very special and a special status during that period.
For sure.
Okay. Well, definitely have some follow-up on that. And let's just go ahead and, since we're at the end of the segment, let's go ahead and end this one. And we'll come back on the other side and wrap up this discussion about, again, Lady Sapiens and women's role in prehistory. Back in a minute. What do you use for appointment and task scheduling? I used to constantly move things around in my calendar that were just tasks I needed to do in favor of meetings. Now I let an intelligent AI do that with Motion. In Motion, all I have to do is create tasks with a soft or hard deadline, state how long I think it will take, and whether it can be broken up, and Motion does the rest. It puts the task where it's a best fit for me getting it done by the deadline. The scheduler then puts appointments with people wherever they schedule and moves the tasks around them. Support the APN with a little kickback if you sign up and try Motion for free at www.arcpodnet.com/motion. That's arcpodnet.com/motion.
Did you know we have lots of great shows on the Archaeology Podcast Network? Head over to arcpodnet.com and you can see all the shows that are currently producing podcasts. Scroll down a bit more and you'll see some great shows from the past that still have great content. Search for your favorite shows on your podcasting app or listen right on the page at arcpodnet.com.
Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 189, third and final segment. And again, we're talking about Lady Sapiens. And if you haven't seen the book or the documentary, take a look down at your device. It's in the show notes there. We'll link to it so you can go check that out. Pretty fascinating stuff. And, you know, the direction research needs to go. So, Rachel, I think you had a follow-up to something that was mentioned earlier.
Yeah. So what is interesting to me about some of the things you've talked about so far, Thomas, is a lot of this is like reanalysis of either artifacts, like actual skeletons or the paintings, like a reanalysis from a different point of view to see if we can figure out what the sex of the person was that either was the skeleton or created the paintings or the beads or whatever. And I'm wondering if you and your researchers think that there's a lot of reanalysis that might need to be done to sort of counteract the maybe preconceived notions of researchers from the 1900s and early 2000s that might have made incorrect conclusions, might have drawn incorrect conclusions because of their biases.
Well, that's completely possible. I don't know. I'm mainly a director. I make documentary.
Yeah.
I'm
not right. Scientist. Right.
I'm not capable of telling you what I can say. For example, if I take this new techniques of sex analysis by this inner ear that we are talking inside Lady Sapiens, there's this very great researcher José Braga who works in Toulouse, who find a new way of sexing the skulls with the form of the cochlea, which is an organ, the hearing organ that we use when we are listening to your podcast. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's the main organ for hearing. It's shaped like a snail, you know, like a it turns and like a snail. And when the person died, the organ disappeared because it's organic matter. It's flesh and bone, so it disappears. But it left the imprints of the shape of the cochlea inside the brain, inside the bones. And the bone is at the skull at this place is very strong. It's named the Petrus bone, so it's very strong. Mm-hmm. And so with a very new technique, which is X-ray tomography, you can take the information of the imprints of the cochlea and measure it. And well, José Braga had this idea of measuring the cochlea of two different ethnic groups. one in Europe and one in South Africa, because he's working with those two with researcher from South Africa. And so mm-hmm. they wanted to know if there is a difference between an ethical difference on the form of the cochlea between those two population. And so he began to make some measurements. And what he found is when you don't take care of the size of the cochlea, when you okay. don't take account mm-hmm. of the size, you take all the cochlea and you say, okay, it's size one. You have a very difference between two groups, and those two groups are not ethnicals. There are six different.
Oh,
one group okay. is male and one group is female.
Interesting.
And so, and what is very interesting about that, it's very, very accurate. It's 95% accurate. So, wow. and it's not depending on the age. So, for instance, we have, a lot of paleoanthropologists know that a lot of skulls are from children, and children, it's very difficult to know the sex because mm-hmm. their bone are not completely finished, and so it's not easy to tell if it's a boy or a girl. The hips are not completely formed, so and they haven't been able to have a child for the girl, so they don't know if those children is a boy or a girl, but with the cochlea, you can tell that.
Mm.
And what he's researching is to know if it's the same thing on primates, and maybe on Neanderthal, and maybe on Erectus, or maybe on early humans. So when he will ended his technique, maybe he would tell the possibility of sex difference. Very old fossils, like I don't mm-hmm. know, all the early human found in Africa, or Neanderthal child, or Neanderthal person, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. incredible, because you will have the possibility of having a very different point of view of those fossils mm. and all the environment of the fossil that has been discovered. So
yeah.
it's another technique like the DNA. The DNA is very accurate, but the DNA just stops around 100,000 years ago. Well, you can find DNA which are a little bit more older than that, but it's very, very right. difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't depend on the environment. The form of the cochlea is still the same in plain desert and in tropical environments. Mm-hmm. It won't change. It won't change the form. So in those environments, it's very difficult to find DNA. Well, you can mm-hmm. tell by the cochlea if mm-hmm. it's a woman or a man, if it's a girl or a boy. And this will surely change a lot of things in future archaeology. I think also about paleogenetics. Paleogenetics tells us mm-hmm. so much thing about those ancient humans. What strikes us, all the team that work on Lady Sapiens, and I have to say that I'm not alone in this project. I work with Eric Pincas, which is my co-author, and the book was written also by Jennifer Kerner, which is a prehistorian, very famous prehistorian in France.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Very, very nice woman also. What strikes us is that this information about how do those women looks, those paleo, upper paleolithic women looks? Because you can tell that with the DNA. And for example, we were thinking that, okay, we came from Africa. So when we arrive at minus 45,000 years ago in Europe, we were dark skinned. So that's
right.
obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've heard before is that, well, on those latitudes, the sun is very less bright, and so you have less UVs, and it's very problematic when you must synthesize vitamin D for your the constructions, the construction of your bones and teeth, mm-hmm. because you need vitamin D to put the calcium, the minerals on the bones to make them strong. Mm-hmm. So usually people's scientists think that in more or less 10,000 years, all this African population changed to a much more lighter skinned population. But what DNA told us, it's that not true. That's very different. The story is that what DNA told us is that European people kept their dark skin from minus 45,000 years ago until 8,000 years ago. So from the whole Upper Paleolithic period and the start of the Neolithic, European people and Asiatic people, Homo sapiens, were dark-skinned. Mm-hmm. So that's a very different way of thinking things. Mm-hmm. Because you don't you have all sort of representation of Homo sapiens, you know, walking the steps of Europe and Asia, you know, with those rags on them, and they're weird and, you know, like hobos on the lands. Well, that's not true also, you know. Mm-hmm. They were dark-skinned. Yeah. Were very, very fond of how they were looking, and they had blue eyes. They had blue eyes. 80% of the DNA found inside those fossils says that there are blue eyes. And so that's two questions. Why, how did they keep those dark-skinned, and why did they have blue eyes? So this question I asked to Evelyn Yeyer, which is a geneticist, in the Musée de l'Homme in Paris. And she explained to us that Homo sapiens kept the skin black or dark all those years because they are feeding on animal fat. And animal fat is very rich on vitamin D. And stopped eating those animal flesh that you can find in the marrow of the bones. For example, you can see in the site in the archaeological record that they eat they crush the bones to eat the marrow inside.
Okay.
So they don't need for the skin to build this vitamin D from the sun. They don't care. They eat fat. So what's the purpose of going lighter? You know, we don't care. And so this is, and they changed their diet in the Neolithic around 8,000 years ago. They became they began to eat cereals, and cereals didn't have any vitamin D inside, and so they began to have lighter skin because they changed diet, and that's the main reason of how on those latitudes. The skin of the Homo sapiens changed from dark to light, and the question of blue eyes is a very interesting also story because there's not purpose for having blue eyes, brown eyes, you know, green eyes. There's no biological explication besides culture and social. What Evelyn Ayer told us is that sometimes in a group or a population, you have this those people who are mating with each other based on a special characteristic, and that characteristic was at that period blue eyes. So it tells us that at a certain point in our story of the evolution. It's not the biology who guides us, who fuels our evolution. It's the culture, the way we are living together. And that's also a very interesting way of thinking the humankind evolution. There's a lot of story about that. I mean, with the story of how they raised children, how woman was not the only person taking care of the child, the way of empathy plays a role very important inside those group of people that builds all our way of having dealing with the group, dealing with the babies, organizing the thing to do inside the groups. That's a very important story also. And that gives us very different thinking about prehistory. Prehistory, for sure, it's a moment where humanity has to deal with a nature that he didn't dominate. But that's not also a story about cruelty and bestiality. That's what those person from the 19th century told us. It's a story also about love, about emotion, about taking care about each other, about taking care of the babies, of the children, of raise them together in a group, and not about only, you know, bestiality and cruelty and fighting and striving for life. That's not true.
Yeah. Okay, man, this has been so great. Some of this I remember hearing when we watched the documentary, which was just really well done. I really appreciated how that is, because so many so many documentaries about, I guess, prehistory in the past, they make so many assumptions where they don't know what's going on, and then it really gives an incorrect perception of the past to the people that are watching it, because most people watching these documentaries, they don't study this sort of thing. You know, they have other jobs and careers and they're trying to learn something about the past. And when you make those little assumptions, like a lot of documentaries have in the past, of just sexual differences, you know, men did this and women did this, that just gets implanted in our brains. And it's nice to, I guess, have a different perspective on that and start to change that narrative. So as we're nearing the end of this podcast, I'm just wondering, you know, you, like you said, you're an author and a director and a documentary filmmaker. What's next for you in this space? Are you staying in the prehistory space here? Cause I know you did Who Killed the Neanderthal as well. So you're definitely interested in this topic.
Well, just before tell you about what I'm doing now, I would just have a word about those lady sapiens who steps all around Europe and Asia and America after. What we're talking about, lady sapiens, is the diversity of women. And we're not saying that lady sapiens was a Wonder Woman of prehistory. That's not true.
Right.
Lady sapiens is plural. Diverse. It plays a lot of roles inside those group of people. They gain prestige, a lot of prestige. They also made a lot of extraordinary things. But we're not saying that, well, everything was done by a woman. You know, that's not
right.
True.
Right. Yeah.
It's a balance role between men and women, between younger and older. That kept the groups alive and the groups functional for future life. So that's very important to say that also.
Yeah, definitely.
Well said.
For my future project, well, I have several. I'm working on a very enthusiastic project about paleontology with a guy, a scientific guy, which leading a team in Denver City. About the first million year after the end of the dinosaurs, this very great paleontologist, his name is Tyler Lyson, and he's working with Gussie McCracken on this period, and they both because of this discovery that they found in coral bluffs, which is just near Colorado Spring.
Okay.
They can tell the story about how life rebound after the asteroid strike. And that's a very appealing story for how our world began when all was chaos and crumbling. So this is very different from prehistory because we are in deep time, but it's also very enthusiastic. And this team is, I spent 3 weeks with them and, it was incredible and I love it.
Awesome.
So
that's my next movie that will be aired broadcast in I think next year.
Cool. Okay.
That is that super interesting, because you always hear about the asteroid strike for dinosaurs as like, okay, so dinosaurs, asteroid, then no dinosaurs. And this is like nothing discussed about what happened or like right after that happened. And I'm sure
like,
there's
what was that transition like?
Yeah. And I'm sure there's geological evidence of, you know, just how the world changed. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So
yeah, totally.
It's the first time that that they discover so much about mammals, crocodiles, turtles,
for sure,
even birds, because we also, well, not in Coir Bluff, they didn't discover birds in Coir Bluff, but we went to see Daniel Field in Cambridge, which tells us about the story of birds.
Okay.
And so we have all those big you know, groups of animals that conquer this ecosystem that were completely freed from dinosaurs, and that leads to the world we know now. So how it just started first million years is very interesting, because it's a story about how plant, animals, and climates all together build things to make life as we know it now. And if there's not this as I say, triangle of this major group, animals, plants, and climates. Mm-hmm. If that's not working, that is a big problem that we are knowing now today.
Okay. Well, we definitely look forward to that. As I mentioned, for our listeners, take a look down at your show notes, and we have some links to some of these things Thomas has done, and we'll try to find some more to put in there so you can absorb all of this. And of course, we look forward, like I said, to your next documentary coming out next year. That just sounds like a fascinating topic. Archaeologists don't really do dinosaurs, but we're interested in paleontology anyway.
We're still interested, though.
Yeah, we're still interested.
I will tell you about some of a project I'm working on, so, which is more archaeological.
Okay.
Right.
Nice. All right. Well, Thomas, again, thanks a lot for coming on to the show.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Rachel.
Yeah, we're happy to have you on again anytime, and thanks for staying up late to do this interview. So with that, I think we will see you next week. We have a couple of interviews coming up, actually, so, or at least one more interview that we have on the books. So it's kind of the season of interviews for us right now, which is really great. Mm-hmm. And then we'll get back to a couple of news episodes. So with that, I think we'll end this podcast, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
This is Chris Webster, founder of the APN and one of the chief editors. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. If you want to keep the conversation going and support us along the way, go to arcpodnet.com/members. That's arcpodnet.com/members. And thanks for listening.